Your North Carolina Reading Service presents The Indie Week. This issue, published June 22nd, 2022. I am John Federson, your reader this week. The program, as always, intended for our audience of blind and print-impaired folks. A beautiful chamber music is provided by two individuals that came in late to the studio, just bringing in their grand piano and violin. I have to confess I don't know anything about them, but they seem to be doing fine. We'll just let them go about their business and hear again from them at the end of the program. Well, with the exception of one article in IndieWeek.com, the online version of this paper, all articles I'm reading for the print edition, and the first by Amanda Abrams is titled Caring for More. Lincoln Community Health Center in Durham always seems to be bustling. The patients drifting in and out of the clinic's main location on Fayetteville Street offer a snapshot of the city's lower-income population, a mix of black, white, and Latino residents who are there for low-cost medical, dental, mental health, or pharmacy services. Heidi Flores is just leaving the facility. With her T-shirt, cutoffs, and shy smile, she looks like the young woman on the precipice of adulthood that she is. She was here for a checkup. It was my first checkup, actually, says Flores, who just turned 20. She doesn't have health insurance and had been worried about how much a visit to a primary care provider might cost. She's seen her aunt receive bill after bill following medical visits. In response, Flores, like several of her friends, has simply stayed away. But the health center charges on a sliding scale, and her appointment only cost her $20. Happily, everything looked fine in this visit, though she had some blood work done and is waiting on results. Flores says she'd definitely come more often if she had health insurance. Flores and roughly 600,000 other low-income North Carolinians may be in luck. Early this month, the North Carolina Senate overwhelmingly approved a bill that would expand Medicaid for people earning up to 138% of the federal poverty level. That's about $18,000 for an individual. After almost a decade of resisting Medicaid expansion, the Senate's vote was historic, but it was not decisive. To become law, the bill must still pass the state House of Representatives, where the reception is likely to be much chillier. No group arguably stands to gain as much from Medicaid expansion as community health centers and their patients. Located across the state, these mission-driven nonprofit clinics, also known as federally qualified health centers, FQHCs, are legally obligated to accept everyone, regardless of ability to pay. They see roughly 560,000 North Carolinians. The vast majority are poor, and 40% lack health insurance. In the Triangle, four community health organizations run a total of about 27 clinics, reaching from Lewisburg, just about east of Wake County, to Siler City in western Chatham County. Each one is a little different, but generally they offer all primary care to adults and kids, dental care, and some mental health services. The clinics and their patient, more than 100,000 Triangle residents, would vastly benefit if Medicaid were expanded. Claretta Foy, Lincoln's CEO, says, "We see a very sick population. Diabetes, hypertension, COPD, asthma. A lot of our patients have all of those. Those chronic conditions are best managed through preventive care and regular checkups, but over half the center's patients lack health insurance or are underinsured, paying for lab tests or specialists out of pocket. With inflation spiking, even $20 to see a provider can be prohibitive. The result is patients who wind up much sicker, often needlessly so. Problems that could have been prevented early on may blossom into full-blown crises, and patients with little recourse may wind up at the emergency room." Dr. Raleigh Rumley, a primary care provider with Advanced Community Health in Wake County, wrote in an email, I had a patient with a large diabetic foot ulcer who was sent to the emergency department due to concerns of osteomyelitis, an infection in the bone. Because of their lack of insurance, the emergency department just made sure they were stable and discharged them. Not obtaining the expensive tests needed to check the severity of that ulcer. Thanks to an assistance program that helped with cost, the patient saw an orthopedist the next week, but in the end, part of their foot had to be amputated. There's no shortage of similar stories among FQHC providers. Patients who urgently needed surgery but had to wait because they didn't have insurance. People diagnosed with cancer who postponed care because they didn't want their family to be burdened with high medical bills after they died. Medicaid coverage would end those life or death dilemmas, and it would allow beneficiaries to receive preventive care to keep them healthier in the first place. But there would be a secondary benefit for the health centers. Not only would their patients get better treatment under Medicaid, the clinics themselves would receive reimbursements for care that could be used to strengthen their service provision. Just about all FQHCs in states that have expanded Medicaid have seen a significant increase in revenues. Brendan Riley, Vice President for Governmental Relations and External Affairs at the NC Community Health Center Association, says, part of the community health center model is doing a lot with very little. By our mission and requirements, health centers reinvest all reimbursements into expanding access to care. So the absence of Medicaid expansion is really capping our potential to care for more patients and expand to a broader array of comprehensive services. Daniel Liparelli, the CEO of Neighbor Health Center, that's an FQHC in Central Raleigh, says, first of all, the centers could see more patients. The need is much larger than there are community health centers. Providers at some clinics report being asked to see increasing numbers of patients every day because demand for their low-cost services is so great. And with more revenues coming in, the centers could broaden their range of offerings to wraparound services like chronic disease management and nutrition. In particular, just about every FQHC leader mentions a major uptick in the need for behavioral health services. Among adults with PTSD in the wake of the pandemic, young people struggling with anxiety, and those with substance abuse issues seeking medically assisted treatment, it's becoming an urgent priority among all the area's FQHCs, but they can't meet the need without the funding to hire more providers. Brian Toomey, CEO of Piedmont Health Services, that's the largest FQHC in the Triangle, with clinics in Orange, Chatham, and Alamance counties, thinks Medicaid expansion itself could reduce some of that demand. Quote, you take someone who's uninsured, has chronic conditions, is working, needs to take care of their health, and is worried about their existence. To take that burden of anxiety off their plate, that would be tremendous for them. Our depression screenings will improve because of it, we think. Next, we have an article by Jasmine Gallup from Holly Springs titled Backward Momentum. Legal risks, lack of understanding, existing protections. Those were all excuses that members of the Holly Springs Town Council gave last week as they stalled signing into Wake County's Non-Discrimination Ordinance, NDO, which would defend LGBTQ people from bigotry in the workplace, retail stores, and elsewhere. The real reason for the Town Council's inaction, however, is simple. It's homophobia, says Donna Friend, a six-year Holly Springs resident who lives with her wife, Linda. The two have been married for 9 years and partners for 41 years. Friend says, The town council's discussion was all based on homophobia. There's no question about it. It wasn't really about any legitimate concern. I don't understand how our town council swears an oath to protect all its citizens, and yet marginalized people they don't want to protect. What happens in the nail salon if someone who's trans wants to come in and have their nails done, and they don't want to let them in? Friend was about one of about 40 people who showed up outside the Holly Springs Law Enforcement Center on Tuesday as council members inside discussed whether to adopt the NDO, which not only protects LGBTQ people, but also outlaws discrimination based on race, ethnicity, hair, creed, sex, pregnancy, marital status, veteran status, age, and disability. The crowd carried rainbow flags and colorful signs urging the council to say yes to the NDO and respect my existence or expect my resistance. Chuck Tryon, another one of the protesters, says he and others wanted to make their voices heard during the town council workshop, where there were no public comments. Quote, the town is still proving resistance to supporting a non-discrimination ordinance, and it really makes no sense. I was extremely heartened to see so many people out supporting the rally. I think there are a lot of people in town who recognize the stakes of this. Holly Springs residents started becoming concerned with the town council's attitude towards LGBTQ community earlier this month when the council refused to pass a proclamation recognizing Pride Month, says Tryon. Quote, it's really hurtful to see that expression of disrespect coupled with other attempts to either curtail LGBTQ rights or to use fear of LGBTQ people as a kind of political prop. It bothers me a great deal to see these attacks taking place. Tryon, Friend, and others showed up to comment in favor of the proclamation earlier this month, standing 24 strong against one naysayer, resident Steve Schneider, who compared gay and trans people, quote, to serial killers and pedophiles. He said at the council meeting, future generations suffer if we deny the reality of two genders or that men cannot become pregnant or that homosexual marriage isn't marriage at all. Being true to who you are means accepting the way God made you. God does not make gay people or trans the same way he does not make serial killers and pedophiles. End quote. 18 people submitted written comments in favor of the Pride Month proclamation and NDO, while only 3 opposed. This response came in spite of Councilwoman Christy Bennett putting out a call on Facebook for people to show up in protest of the Pride Proclamation. Quote, the Pride Proclamation is significant because even if it's just a public statement, it tells members of the town that they are affirmed and that they're welcome in the community, said Tryon, adding that just one affirming space for LGBTQ youth can reduce the risk of suicide and mental health challenges. Quote, there are many parents who don't accept their LGBTQ children. Having that space for someone and ensuring they know they're protected, I think, would make a world of difference. The town council's discussion of the NDO on Tuesday had a continuous theme that an ordinance protecting LGBTQ people and people of color was, quote, not right for Holly Springs and its 40,000 residents. The NDO, which has been adopted by Wake County and 19 municipalities in North Carolina, including Raleigh, Apex, and Durham, allows people who feel they've been discriminated against to file a complaint, which leads to an out-of-court mediation. If the mediation is unsuccessful, individuals can then file a civil lawsuit to obtain an injunction against the business or organization in question. If Holly Springs adopted the NDO, Wake County would be responsible for responding to complaints and would cover the costs of enforcement for the first 18 months. Despite the success of Wake County's ordinance, however, council members remain unwilling to adopt it, with some suggesting that town attorney rewrite the NDO more narrowly for Holly Springs. Mayor Sean Mayefsky, Mayor Pro Tem Daniel Berry, Christy Bennett, Timothy Forrest and Sean McGrath all took positions against the ordinance Tuesday, citing legal concerns and worries about enforcement and questioning whether the ordinance was even needed. The sole voice in favor of the NDO was Councilmember Aaron Wolf, who, visibly frustrated, asked his colleagues to specify what problems they had with the existing NDO and what changes they would request for a Holly Springs-specific ordinance. He said, "The workshop on Tuesday, if it did nothing else, illustrated beyond a reasonable doubt that there are massive, gaping holes in anti-discrimination law that affect the residents of Holly Springs. The NDO that Wake County put together covers all of those gaps. Why would we not want to fill gaps that allow people in our community to be discriminated against?" In the past month, community members have made it clear that discrimination is still a problem in Holly Springs, says Wolf, citing a recent conversation with a transgender resident. Quote, "He does not feel safe being his true, authentic self in Holly Springs, and that's a problem. To sit there and say, Holly Springs is fine the way it is, there's nothing to be fixed, is just to bury your head in the sand and say the lived experiences of the countless residents who have reached out to us don't matter. We could make a real impact to law in Holly Springs that makes a difference for our residents, and at the same time affirm their existence in our town and their importance to our community. And we are refusing to do both." Wolf says the exact reasoning for council members in the NDO is a mystery to him, given the demonstrated success of Wake County's ordinance and the multiple months council members have had to seek answers to their questions. But even after the lack of progress during Tuesday's workshop, Wolf has continued talking to council members, imploring them to take action. Quote, "I've said privately to my colleagues, just because you guys push this aside does not mean it's going to go away. We're going to continue to have pressure on us, not just from private residents, but also from our business community. If we can come together and find a solution, then we can move on. Unfortunately, out of the five of us, I seem to be the only one who's really interested in finding a solution in any reasonable time. It's immensely frustrating. It feels like a no-brainer to me. I feel like the arguments that were made and the answers that were received make it a pretty easy, obvious choice to approve this, but they still won't." Mayevsky, who was elected to his first term as mayor in 2021, may have been swayed in part by businessman Robert Luddy, who happens to be his top individual campaign donor. Luddy, the founder of Thales Academy Private Schools and Franklin Academy Charter School, is a conservative activist who gave $5,000 to Mayevsky's campaign. Luddy has also been crystal clear about his feelings towards LGBTQ people, defending Florida's Don't Say Gay bill, and including policies in his private schools that prohibit students from promotion, affirmation, or discussion of LGBTQ people or issues. Christine Kelly, a former Holly Springs Town Council member, now candidate for North Carolina House District 37, seemed equally frustrated with the council's stonewalling during a phone conversation last week. Kelly, who challenged Mayevsky in the 2021 election for mayor, has been critical of the current council. Like Wolf, Kelly pushed for the NDO while she was still on council and met resistance. Ultimately, the council decided to revisit the NDO after Wake County had enacted it, and they were able to gather more information, she says. Quote, "Now they pushed it under the rug, and Wolf is the only one talking about it. What do we know that we didn't know then? We know now that the NDO is going well, and Wake County is going to manage the cost. There's no downside for the town. It's more stall tactics." Holly Springs is one of several more conservative communities in Wake County that is moving backward on LGBTQ rights. Many activists are seeing backlash after previous victories this year as local officials hesitate to pass protections and state legislators moved forward with House Bill 755 or the Don't Say Gay bill. Overall, the political climate is frightening for people like Friend and her wife Linda. The couple are transplants from New York, and while they originally felt comfortable moving to liberal Wake County, they're now beginning to wonder what challenges may lie ahead. Quote, "We're really worried about this midterm election and where we're going to be at the end of it. I see a rollback to a lot of things that everyone enjoys as their civil liberties being taken away. If they rescind the same-sex marriage act, what do we do now? It wasn't that long ago that if I was in the hospital and went into intensive care, Linda would not have been able to visit me because she's not recognized as a family member. For that reason, friend, we'll continue fighting for her own rights and the rights of other LGBTQ people," she says. "I'm not backing away from this one. We're going to do the best we can to make sure that some sort of ordinance get passed. And if it turns out the ordinance is all about the groups that are already protected and they're going to kick the ones who are marginalized to the street, then we'll really know what this town is about." Election day is November 8th. The next round of elections for the Holly Springs Town Council is in 2023, when McGrath and Wolf will be up for re-election. The remaining members, Mayevsky, Berry, Bennett, and Forrest, will not face elections until 2025. All right, the cover story in Indie Week by Jasmine Gallup from Raleigh. Summer understaffed. Aqua blue light ripples off the tile walls of the Pullen Aquatic Center last Tuesday, home to an Olympic-sized swimming pool and more than a dozen lifeguards in training. The teenagers, mostly wearing casual exercise shorts and T-shirts, are waiting for their chance to dive in and practice the skills they've learned in a week-long training class. Those skills include lifting their partners out of the water, giving CPR using a rescue mask, and using backboards designed to stabilize people with neck injuries. Jackson Jones Sullater, 16, poking fun at his partner Jaden Phillips, also 16, says, "If you're being lifted, it's really hard because if some members of your group can't lift you up properly, you will drown." Says, "I've been partners with him all week. I've been having to lift him out of the water," Phillips explained, gesturing to Jones Salater's 6-foot frame. "The teen must outweigh her by at least 30 pounds. You're so heavy. I'm not saying anything's bad. You're just heavy." Learning lifeguard skills has been challenging at times, the teenagers agree, but also fun. Olivia Poteet, 15, says, "You have to trust the people you're working with. You're practicing saving someone drowning, so you have to lay face down in the water and just trust they're going to get you. The first day, that's what we did. I had no idea who anyone was, but I've made friendships now." The group of teenage applicants, soon to be literal lifesavers, are also a saving grace for Ken Heisler, Assistant Director of Raleigh's Parks, Recreation, and Cultural Resources Department. Raleigh, like cities nationwide, has been struggling to find lifeguards for its pools, 4 that are opened year-round and 4 that are typically open from Memorial to Labor Day in early September. The national lifeguard shortage, however, forced Raleigh officials to keep summer pools closed this year through mid-June. Even now, only 2 of the 4 summer pools are open, and only during weekends. At year-round pools, staff have had to close section, reduce hours, and limit swim lessons. City officials prioritized opening Biltmore and Longview pools, both located in low-income neighborhoods in southeast Raleigh. Unlike in some richer, whiter parts of the city, there aren't many private neighborhood pools in the area for families to use. And the pools there are an important resource for children and active adults, says Heisler. Quote, "When we looked at our seasonal operation, our priorities were looking at those communities that may not have access to a pool. Our focus was, how do we make sure those communities that don't have another resource are prioritized? That's why Longview opened first, because we're the community pool in that neighborhood." Raleigh's pools, Heisler says, serve 4 different groups: families and children who use the pools for recreation, people who are taking water safety and swim lessons, people who swim regularly as exercise, and third-party groups like swim teams. At the moment, Heisler is trying to ensure people can use summer pools for recreation and find swimming instruction at year-round facilities. Quote, "Our first responsibility is to serve the public. Right now, what we're trying to do is make sure we can maintain opportunities at the year-round pools. We've been able to balance those four communities to a certain extent." The lifeguard shortage is not a new problem. Staffing public pools and beachfronts has been an issue for the last 20 years, says Bernard Fisher, director of the American Lifeguard Association. A drop in the number of interested applicants combined with a spike in the construction of new public pools created the perfect storm. The ratio of lifeguards to pools became unbalanced, Fisher says. Increased development also created more beachfront area for fewer lifeguards to patrol. The situation was bad but not unmanageable, Fisher says, at least until the coronavirus pandemic. Quote, "We usually bring in about 300,000 new lifeguard candidates every year. The first year of the pandemic, we pretty much didn't train anyone. Also, the certification is good for 2 years. So the people who got those certifications 2 years before the pandemic, they needed to come and renew it, but we missed them." That pandemic created a backup in the number of new lifeguards coming through the training pipeline. So now, as officials are trying to fully reopen pools, there's a severe shortage of workers. Heisler says, "We didn't have as much demand during the pandemic. Therefore, there wasn't as much of a push for workers. There just weren't as many people coming to the pools. Now, as that pandemic has died down, demand has increased rapidly. Many more people are coming to public pools, and the city, like other industries, is playing catch-up. About one-third of the pools across the country will be closed this summer because of the shortage, increasing to about half of all pools in August," says Fisher. He says, "The pools that have opened, we're not going to be able to keep them all open until Labor Day because we rely heavily on the youth that have to go back to school." Come August, Heisler anticipates a more severe shortage of lifeguards as high school and college students go back to school. Staffing has historically been a problem during the earliest and latest weeks of summer. One possible solution is to hire retirees, according to Fisher. Quote, "They come down in their swimming laps for fitness and health. They enjoy it. They like the community and want to help. We just need to let them know that, hey, there is no age limit to coming down and getting trained and helping your community pool." Per Fisher's advice, Heisler and other Raleigh officials are trying to reach out to active adults and retirees, many of whom come to the pool daily and have schedules that enable them to work during daytime hours. City staff are also considering offering retention bonuses for lifeguards who will stay on until Labor Day. Another problem Raleigh faces is getting qualified applicants. The city is now seeing more applicants for lifeguard positions, but not everyone who applies can pass the swim assessment, says Heisler. Quote, "Even if someone's interested in becoming a lifeguard, they have to be able to pass the certification requirements, and that's not something that everybody's able to accomplish. Hiring lifeguards across the country has been challenging for many of us because it's a little more physically demanding than a lot of part-time jobs. One solution to that problem may be hiring lifeguards with shallow water certifications, which are easier to get than deep water. Shallow water lifeguards can't guard deep diving areas but can guard wading pools, shallow water areas, and 5-foot lap lanes, freeing up more experienced lifeguards to watch the deep end." Fisher adds that cities should also do their best to keep pools open for swimming classes and lifeguard training, which create better swimmers and more lifeguards. Well, the good news is that Raleigh officials have been able to hire more lifeguards in recent weeks, 18 have been hired since June, and another 19 recently graduated training and are in the midst of the hiring process. To open all the city pools full-time, officials need to hire about 50 more lifeguards, according to Heisler. Recent news coverage of the crisis has helped get the word out, he says. Quote, there have been a lot of parents recently who will look to their kids and go, you can swim, you can meet those requirements, let's go and see if we can help out. That's been super exciting. Another community member recognized their local pool was going to be impacted and went out and found teenagers they already had a relationship. They said, let's go to the job fair and submit our applications because we know that if we can be guards, that helps get our community pool open. At least one teenager applied for a lifeguard position this month because of recent news coverage. Addie Corral, 15, says she heard about the job opportunity through WRAL and her aunt encouraged her to apply. She says, I've actually worked before. I worked for a little bit at a general store, but I felt like it would be a fun job to do. It was better pay than what I've been getting. When my brother started lifeguarding, it was like $7.25. That raise in hourly pay is another strategy Raleigh officials are using to try to recruit new lifeguards, says Heisler. Raleigh raised starting pay for lifeguards from $9 an hour to $13. More experienced lifeguards can make up to $15 an hour. The strategy seems to be working. Phillips and Jones Salater each said the higher pay was one of the reasons they decided to apply. Jones Salater plans to use the money he makes this summer to buy 3 new rolls of leather. One of his hobbies is crafting leather bags and wallets. If city officials are able to hire enough lifeguards, they plan to open the Lake Johnson pool next, says Heisler. They also want to add weekday hours at Biltmore and Longview as temperatures climb into the 90s. Heisler says, 30 minutes after we opened Longview, there were already kids in the pool and they were jumping around. For me, that's why we do what we do. There's nothing better during the summer than family and friends having the opportunity to just come together. That's what the pools create. They're community gathering spaces. They break down barriers. It's just an opportunity for kids to be kids, for neighbors to connect in a relaxing atmosphere, maybe meet somebody new. All righty, Hannah Kaufman from Orange County Column on Climate Action Consensus Crisis. On climate work in Orange County, it's been 2 steps forward, 1 back. Most recently, it's the unexpected shelving of a countywide climate council that had made progress in sharing information and planning climate action initiatives among local experts and governments. The board was suspended, its members offended, but hopefully the situation will soon be amended. Last April, the Orange County Board of County Commissioners officially reorganized and effectively suspended the County Climate Council based on the recommendations in a report from the county's Climate Council Review Subcommittee that was formed in October of 2021 with the purpose of evaluating that council. The 31-member council formed in September 2019 to share information and collaborate on climate change initiatives between local jurisdictions, schools, experts, community members, and environmental advocacy institutions. The council had issues with attendance, compounded by remote meetings and COVID-19 from the get-go, but had successfully completed multiple projects, and members were in the process of trying to organize themselves internally by drafting bylaws and working on a memorandum of understanding, that's an MOU, to better communicate between the jurisdictions of Chapel Hill, Carrboro, and Hillsborough. That Climate Council Review Subcommittee, spearheaded by Commissioner Jamazetta Bedford and joined by Commissioners Amy Fowler and Anna Richards, looked into the progress and performance of that council. Council members say the committee took the council's efforts to organize as a sign of dysfunctionality, and ultimately the committee members decided more was wrong with the council than was right. Bedford says, I think this was totally ineffective. I mean, they couldn't make quorum. The membership had never been completed. They weren't diverse. I don't think they were ineffective or operating council. Members who were on the council came to starkly different conclusions, though. At the April 26th meeting, when the council was suspended, the chair of that council, Melissa McCulloch, gave a speech about alleged inaccuracies and mistakes, including the assertion that the group couldn't consistently make a quorum within that subcommittee report. Following her thorough address, the subcommittee presented its findings, and the seven county commissioners discussed potential solutions, including disbanding the council entirely, until the commissioners came to the decision to suspend and reorganize it to follow a model in which it would meet three times a year following its suspension. Council members say the subcommittee's recommendations were made without the collaboration with the council members, and the majority of these members say they had no idea the council faced an imminent possibility of suspension. McCulloch says she wasn't aware that the commissioners would be taking action until the day of the meeting. Quote, I found out rather inadvertently. Somebody saw it, and they called me up and said, do you realize this is on the agenda? McCulloch says information wasn't shared with the council members. She notified the other three elected officials who represent Carrboro, Chapel Hill, and Hillsborough, but they couldn't attend on such short notice. Quote, that kind of explains why I am the only person who spoke. Amy Ryan, who's represented Chapel Hill in the council, asked Bedford if they would delay the discussions so the other electeds could have some input, and she was told no. Bedford says she knew the council reorganization was going to be on the agenda for a week before the April 26 meeting and still did not notify the council members, something she said she takes accountability for. Quote, I could have handled that better. If I thought about it, I could definitely have sent an email to the whole council to inform them. I'm sure it bothers many of the members. That's a legit complaint. But I don't believe at all that would have changed the 7-0 vote whatsoever, and I think it's a form over substance issue there. Mark McCopless, the founder of the council and a former county commissioner, says the process the commissioners undertook was done, quote, with a very disturbing lack of transparency. If you were a responsible elected official and you saw this committee you thought was not fulfilling its function and didn't have any value and needed to be addressed, you would reach out to the members of the committee and you'd express your thoughts on that to them. Let them know you have these concerns, get feedback, and work together to come to some kind of consensus on what needs to happen. Well, this was clearly a hit job. Since its formation in 2019, the Orange County Climate Council has collaborated on a variety of projects, research initiatives, and climate discussions. One of those included the Climate Action Relational Database, a spreadsheet that incorporates all the initiatives that the different municipalities are carrying out. The database, while seemingly an obvious first step, was crucial to helping each municipality understand what the others had done by consolidating countywide climate actions, says Chapel Hill representative and sustainability expert Donna Rubinoff. Quote, the first thing you have to do is just understand what you're working with. It's not rocket science, but it was needed, and it was important that it happened. Another project initiated under the council was Rubinoff's work directing several student interns to cover climate justice and climate communication strategies and data on how people from various demographics engage with information about climate change. Quote, climate action isn't just about building solar panels and wind and weatherizing houses and the technology. So much of it has to do with the quality of climate communication your organization presents. Research has found that one of the most important and valuable tools for getting people involved in climate action is to get them to simply start talking about it. Rubinoff says she had hoped that this work could eventually help inform the county's climate action plan, which has not yet materialized, despite Carrboro, Chapel Hill, and Hillsborough all having climate plans of their own. The council was also working with the three jurisdictions, mayors and the county board of commissioners chair, to begin the official process of forming an MOU, an exercise that was meant to preempt situations like the suspension of the council, says Sammy Slade, a member of the Carrboro Town Council and a chair for Carrboro on that climate council. Quote, our attorneys were already working on a draft that the council was going to review and provide input on, given the experience we had already acquired by then. So it was just very strange they aborted that process and have taken this unilateral approach. Markopoulos suspects that the suspension of the council was merely political. Quote, nothing really points to the fact that it was disingenuous more than the fact that we went about 8 months without an Orange County representative on the Climate Council. And then all of a sudden, Bedford rolls in for a couple of meetings and she turns around and she gets two of the newest commissioners, who know the least about the history of this stuff, to form a committee with her and tells them why the council is no longer useful and needs to be done away with. But Bedford says the politics between herself and Markopoulos have nothing to do with the reorganization, that the council never notified the commissioners that Orange County's previous representative, Mark DeRosen, who relocated to Florida last year, wasn't showing up to meetings. Bedford says, I have too much to do. I work, and I do this. I'm a grandma, and I'm a mom, to care politically about Markopoulos. It's absurd. I mean, climate just has to be elevated, and it was kind of disappointing to find out that for about 6 months prior, DeRosen had never shown up, and no one, including the elected, had told any of us on the board. Bedford also says it's incorrect to say that her fellow subcommittee member Anna Richards didn't know much about the council, as she was the NAACP representative in the beginning and had attended periodically. Ultimately, Bedford says she had no personal gain from reorganizing the council except to advance county climate action. Quote, for me, it's about this group is wasting staff time, and we don't have time with climate, and we have to get a county climate action plan and get going on this. That's why I was reorganizing. I really did not think we would be suspending. While the suspension was legal under the board's scope of power, Slade says it violated something that goes beyond law, the spirit of the organization. Quote, typically we have laid out instructions for how to dismantle an organization, and for lack of having that, they legally could dismantle it. But the spirit of collaboration and the spirit of how this group formed was violated in that there wasn't an attempt to work and benefit and glean what the experience from the council itself was in a collaborative way with the other jurisdictions and representatives. Spirit aside, the commissioner's chair, Renee Price, says it's the commission's duty to look into councils and committees that are not meeting Orange County standards. Quote, any advisory board serves at the pleasure of the Board of County Commissioners. It would be our responsibility that if an advisory board or commission is having some difficulty, or if we have issues with it, for the sake of everybody, we should investigate. Bedford says it comes down to the council's lack of a specific charge and MOU, something she says she apologizes for on behalf of the elected officials who helped form that council in the first place. Bedford says, it was just bizarre operations. It was really the work of one or two people. It wasn't the Climate Council doing work or sharing information. And in my opinion, that's one of the key things that needs to change. The electeds let constituents down by not having a charge, not having an MOU. We're going to fix it and start again. The commissioner's next step is to create an Orange County Climate Action Plan, something they hope to expedite, given the existing climate plans of the other local jurisdictions. Bedford says the county's fortunate that Carrboro's had a plan for several years. Chapel Hills had one for a year and a half. Hillsborough's is almost finished, so we can copy-paste. Hopefully it shouldn't take us 2 years. We don't have 2 years. Slade says the reorganization has only set the county back in its future work to combat climate change. Quote, We have a very short diminishing window for climate action, and it's just frustrating to be involved with organizations and electeds who set things back as this is doing. Dismantling a group that was trying to find its rhythm is a big disruption to the vital work we have and dealing with the climate emergency on the local level. Price says climate action is a top priority for the county, but in addition to encouraging the use of more expensive climate initiatives like electric vehicles, she also emphasizes the importance of finding ways for underserved communities to participate in mitigating the effects of climate change that impact them most closely. And Price says, we are very concerned about climate change here, and it may appear differently when you talk to different people. They may address it in different ways, but we definitely have to look at it. All right, another from Tomasi McDonald in Durham. In dispute. Durham's Board of Elections this week will review a challenge filed by County Sheriff Clarence Burkhead against, quote, certified unaffiliated candidate Maria Josis, I was pronounced that right, G-O-C-Y-S, Maria Josis' right to be placed on the midterm election ballot in her bid to unseat the incumbent who is seeking a second term. But in an emailed statement to Indy, Joseph this week said, quote, the staff of the Durham County Board of Elections did its job. They thoroughly reviewed the petition signatures and determined that 9,599 signatures were valid. Disqualifying our campaign at this point would, in effect, disenfranchise thousands of voters who want a chance in November. Joseph, who pronounced Joseph, is a Durham native who retired from the FBI in December. 1 month after retiring, she contacted local media and political action committees, talked with friends, reached out to community members, and set up a website in a quest to persuade 4% of Durham's registered voters to sign a petition that would allow her to run as an unaffiliated sheriff's candidate in November. As the Indy previously reported, Josie's may pose a formidable challenge for the incumbent, who is Durham County's first black sheriff. She graduated from Southern High School and worked in East Durham's Wellens Village as a teen. After graduating from East Carolina University, she began a 32-year law enforcement career that started with the Greenville Police Department, followed by 24 years with the FBI. While working for the FBI, Josie led counterterrorism investigations around the globe and was the first woman to lead the FBI's Raleigh office. Before retiring, she worked for 5 years with the FBI's Safe Streets Task Force, which focuses on criminal street gangs in Durham. Burkhead's challenge comes on the heels of an NC Board of Elections announcement last month that Josie's campaign is under investigation to determine why the names of thousands of registered voters that appeared on her petition to get on the ballot are invalid. In a request to keep her name off the fall's midterm ballot, the incumbent also questioned the challenger's political affiliation. Burkett says Josie first registered as a Democrat with the State Board of Elections in 1998 before changing her party affiliation to unaffiliated in November of 2021 and then back to Democrat just 1 month later. The state's general statute, quote, prohibits party changes within 90 days of the filing period, said the sheriff. Josie began her campaign in January after retiring from the FBI in December. Burkhead says, as a Democrat, Maria Josie should have filed for the Democratic primary. She says, however, the 90-day deadline the sheriff cites for switching party affiliation has nothing to do with unaffiliated candidates. It applies only to candidates who want to run in a party primary, she says. Patrick Gannon, a spokesman with the NC Board of Elections, told the Indy in late May that Josie's is set to appear on the November ballot as an unaffiliated candidate for Durham County Sheriff after she submitted a petition with 15,685 signatures to the Board of Elections on May the 17th. Gannon noted the state law required Diocese to collect 9,248 signatures, that's 4% of the registered voters, to appear on the ballot. But state election officials say more than a third of the 15,685 signatures are suspect. Burkhead, in a 7-page challenge filed with the Board of Elections, stated that 41 people who signed the petition are dead. He further cited the state's election officials' investigation before asserting that Joseph's petition, quote, has fraudulent and forged signatures, duplicate signatures, and other irregularities, and that with the elimination of duplicate signatures, Joseph's campaign has not met the 4% threshold to be named on the ballot. Burkett asserts that Joyce's campaign submitted 9,599 signatures that were deemed valid. This exceeded the 9,248 threshold by 351 ballots, he stated. With the elimination of 566 duplicate signatures, the Maria Joseph's campaign fails to qualify as an unaffiliated candidate. Burkhead stated in a memorandum in support of his candidate challenge that his campaign's request for copies of Josie's petition was denied by the County Board of Election, which instead provided with a petition status report. Burkhead's campaign now asserts that two of the 41 voters he claims are dead passed away in 2016, three more died in 2017, one in 2018, two in 2019, five in 2019, six expired last year, and four died this year. Quote, even though the irregularity was caught by the Durham Board of Elections, the submission of the names of deceased individuals is an indication of forgery and fraud, which raises questions about the validity of the other signatures, said the challenge. The incumbent also stated that several Durham County residents whose names appeared on the petition contacted local officials or community members to report that they never signed a petition in support of Joseph's unaffiliated candidacy. Burkhead pointed to a very much alive 87-year-old woman who, after receiving a letter from county elections officials indicating her alleged signature on the petition had been canceled, quote, became upset and informed her children she had never signed a Joseph's petition. Burkhead also pointed to a story that appeared in the India on May 30th when Durham resident Gina Torres Perryman, whose name appeared on the petition, told the Indian in an email that she had not even heard of Joseph's until she received a letter in the mail from the County Board of Elections. Burkhead said that 479 signatures on the petition status report, or 3%, were illegible, and that Joseph's campaign has admitted hiring a signature firm to obtain signatures for the candidate petition that gets paid by the signature, unquote. Burkhead also stated that Joseph's campaign, quote, has not submitted proper finance campaign reports, which makes it impossible and difficult to research and or examine that signature firm for past irregularities or illegal activities. Further, the sheriff stated that last year, on December 13th, Joseph's campaign indicated an organizational political disclosure report, quote, an individual contribution as an in-kind contribution in the amount of $50,900 for a ballot access contract. Burkhead closed his challenge by stating that if local and state elections officials determine that Joseph should not be disqualified, her candidacy, quote, should not be confirmed as unaffiliated until any investigation is completed and 9,599 signatures are verified by contacting the purported signatories. This week, Derek Bowens, the director of Durham County Board of Elections, told Indy that although he could not make public a deliberation time frame, he expects the board will make a decision at the concluding of the hearing, saying in an email, the board must issue its written decision no later than 20 business days from the date the challenge was submitted, which would be June the 28th. Now, I won't be able to read the final article in its entirety by Ayika Dillon. The more things stay the same from Durham. On a Monday evening, Haiti residents, community leaders, and city representatives file into the Monument of Faith Church Sanctuary. The room bustles with anticipation as attendees exchange greetings, scribble their names and addresses on public comment cards. The subject of this meeting is the Durham Housing Authority's proposed Fayette Place project in Haiti. The goal, community reconciliation. Earlier this year, the Housing Authority stirred controversy after tapping Durham Community Partners to redevelop the Fayette Place site. The proposal calls for the construction of 774 affordable housing units on Fayette Place, a parcel of vacant land within that historically black Haiti neighborhood. In 2017, the City of Durham awarded the Housing Authority a $4.2 million grant to purchase the plot, stipulating that the agency create a community engagement program for the project. However, Haiti residents argue that little has been done to include them. Mayor Elaine O'Neill opens the meeting and introduces City Attorney Kimberly Rayburg and Durham Housing Authority CEO Anthony Scott, who outlined the details of the Fayette Place development. Using PowerPoint slides that feature tiny, indiscernible words, Scott explains the project's timeline, selection criteria used in scoring proposals, and the request for proposal process that resulted in the selection of Durham Community Partners. Audience members interrupt Scott often, criticizing his presentation as inaccessible to the visually impaired. "We can't even see the slides. You're talking and we're losing it," says Lavonia Allison, a longtime Durham activist and former chair of the Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People. Scott closes shortly after and the public comment period opens. And to read the rest of this, you can go online to indieweek.org, and also you will see several articles concerning the arts, entertainment, and other items. Also, I may add that the last week's issue of Indie Week includes the Best of the Triangle Awards, a voluminous selection of restaurants, services, etc., that were voted on for awards, and you can find all those results there. So our mysterious, unidentified pianist and violinist are back, reprising our theme music. John Federson for Indie Week is closing this broadcast, which is available, of course, on our podcast section of ncreadingservice.org. And we thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another edition of Indie Week.